Consuls General, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you to today's event and to introduce our speaker, Peter Varghese, AO, Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. As an outsider, it's always seemed to me that there are two kinds of foreign affairs officials. There are the thinkers who think deeply about the world and the operators who get things done. And of course, a first-class foreign service needs officers drawn from the thinkers and the operators. My sense is that in recent decades, the balance has shifted away from thinkers towards the operators. And this is partly, I think, because the calls on the department's time have so greatly increased. There are so many services that missions need to provide that efficiency and execution are very highly prized. I think it's also partly because there are alternatives for thinkers. There are alternatives within government, the intelligence agencies, such as the Office of National Assessments, of which Peter was Director General for some years, and also now, of course, alternatives outside government, for example, the Institute. And the Institute's work has been enriched over the years by a number of former DFAT officers, including Jenny Hayward-Jones, who's with us today, and Anthony Bubalo. This is why I was so heartened by Peter Varghese's appointment as Secretary of the Department in 2012. Peter is certainly a good operator. Anybody who has served as a senior advisor on international affairs to the Prime Minister, as High Commissioner in India, who's headed an intelligence agency, is an operator of the highest calibre. But Peter is also, to my mind, one of the finest thinkers that DFAT has produced. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Varghese is one of the most influential officials in the Australian Public Service. He's also one of the most interesting. He was born in Kenya in 1956 and moved with his family to Brisbane in 1964. He graduated from the University of Queensland, majoring in history. He joined DFAT in 1979. In addition to serving as High Commissioner in India, he served as High Commissioner in Malaysia. He has also served in Washington, Vienna and Tokyo, and he was Director General of ONA from 2004 to 2009. He was appointed an officer in the Order of Australia in 2010 for distinguished service to public administration. As the Secretary of DFAT, he's responsible for managing missions around the world, staffed by a highly intelligent and self-confident workforce. I have some sympathy for him on that score. But he's also been asked to bear a particular management burden in the last few years because of the integration of AusAid into DFAT. Peter told me towards the beginning of the year, actually on the way to the Shangri-La dialogue, that he would like to give a speech to the Institute setting out a practitioner's view of the world. And I'm delighted that this has come to fruition. I should tell you that today's speech will be live tweeted by both the Lowy Institute and, of course, by DFAT, which is up to the minute in terms of digital developments. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Peter Varghese to the stage.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, and good afternoon to all of you. Thank you for coming here today. Michael, thank you for a very generous introduction. I'm not sure I would agree that we have two tribes in DFAT, the thinkers and the doers. You know, we're all good Marxists in foreign affairs and trade. We believe in praxis, so theory and practice are carefully blended. Can I at the outset commend the Lowy Institute for the contribution it makes to our understanding of Australia's place in the world? I think, Michael, the analysis of this institution, its outreach, its expertise, places it very much in the front rank of Australian think tanks, and its reputation has rightly spread well beyond our shores. When I meet each year with our new graduates, I always stress to them the importance of developing a world view which can anchor their career in diplomacy. And many of them, because they're smart, ask me, well, that's all very good, but what is your worldview? How do I see Australia in the world? And how do the big themes of foreign policy, such as interests, power, influence, and values, come together? So my speech today is really an attempt to provide a practitioner's answer to these questions. It's not a comprehensive policy statement or a review of our current foreign policy challenges. Instead, I wish today to offer a personal perspective on the shapers of an Australian worldview. Foreign policy is an ecosystem. Everything is connected to everything else. A change in one area creates consequences in other areas. The grammar of chaos theory finds a distinct echo in foreign policy, even if charting the chain of consequence is more art than science. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade cannot confine itself to foreign policy or even to foreign trade and aid policy. It must deal with Australia's international interests in the round. Managing our major bilateral relationships takes you into the many nooks and crannies of the ecosystem. The economy, strategic policy, immigration, energy security, social policy, aviation negotiations, tourism tax, investment, and a myriad of other issues. Now, we can all marvel at the complexity of it all, but as practitioners, we have to do more than admire the problem. We have to find some order amidst the chaos, build a framework around what we seek to achieve, and have a clear sense of what we can and cannot do. We need to match aspiration to capacity. We need to understand the way in which history has shaped current challenges. We need to understand strategic geography, as well as the character and temperament of our international partners. All foreign policy starts at home, and all foreign policy is a means to an end, to advance the interests of our country and our community. The best foreign policy is anchored in a clear view of those interests and an institutional capacity to advance them. The practice of foreign policy is less about describing the ends than determining the means to get there. And while the ends may be objective, the means are often subjective. How best to achieve our foreign policy objectives will be strongly influenced by how we see power, what relative weight we give to bilateral relations and multilateralism, the balance in our thinking between realism and idealism, the extent to which values shape interests, and so on. These are the anchor points of how Australia looks out on the world and how we conceptualize our strategic environment. They constitute the core elements of a worldview, and no foreign policy can last long without a sense of it. Foreign policy is anchored in interests, but it must also reflect values. Australia's liberal democratic, secular, and multicultural character is fundamental to our sense of self. It is as much of an Australian national interest as our security and prosperity. Giving expression to our values should be seen as a natural part of our international relations. It is true that sometimes the defence of values can be in tension with the advancement of interests. Here, as elsewhere in foreign policy, we strive to strike the right balance. But that balance should be about how best to be true to our core values rather than simply trading values for interests. And we need to start from the premise that values are not there to be imposed on others. They should define who we are, not what we insist others become. Australia's values are the values of an open society. We believe that freedom is best advanced when we nurture an environment where ideas can flourish, where contending philosophies have to make their case in the marketplace of ideas, and where those who govern are held accountable to the governed. Some will argue that as noble as these values may be, they are largely the lived experience of Western democracies, and as such hold little meaning for those, and they are the vast majority, outside that cultural and historical tradition. It has been easy for us to assert our core values as universal values, because from the time of British settlement, Australia has been closely aligned culturally and intellectually with the dominant global powers. We were part of the system which wrote the rules, which authored the International Conventions on Human Rights, and which gave universal reach to our founding principles. We must also recognise that the values of liberal democracy evolved gradually in the West. The journey from the divine right of kings through to one person, one vote was long and difficult. For most of human history, the values which we today think of as self-evident truths, the rule of law, the accountability of the government to the people, freedom of speech and assembly, and a free media, were anything but universal. Yet it seems to me quite unsatisfactory to consign our most cherished ideals to the prosaic logic of time and place. Yes, we are all products of our history, but surely that doesn't mean that our history is incapable of producing a universal truth. In our foreign policy, we should be quietly confident about our values, because the best way to engage the world is with a clear sense of who we are and what we believe in. The Australian community expects us to hold true to the values that define us, and foreign policy is also very much about the values and the principles which we want to see embedded in the international system. Australia's national interests are frequently asserted but rarely defined. At their core, they're timeless, to advance security and prosperity and to contribute to the shaping and running of international institutions which reinforce the rule of law and international norms of behaviour. Australia's sense of itself in the world has evolved. For much of our history, we submerged our national identity within the broader framework of empire. Even in those days, Australia had a sense of its distinctive interests. Witness Deakin's invitation to the US Great White Fleet in 1908, or Billy Hughes at Versailles. But it has only been since the end of the Second World War that we have consciously sought to give a distinctively Australian voice to the definition of our interests and our place in the world. Australia has also shied away from the exercise of power. We have tended to see power as belonging to others. And when we have engaged with the projection of power, we have traditionally been more comfortable in the slipstream than in the lead. If anything, Australia has underestimated its foreign policy weight and the effect on others of what we say and do. We are, after all, the 12th largest economy in the world and the number one global exporter of beef, coal, and iron ore. We're an emerging energy superpower and have the third largest pool of investment funds under management. If there is a gap between our international weight and our ambivalence about the exercise of power, it reflects a history of strategic anxiety shaped by many things: a relatively small population inhabiting a large continent, that for all but the last several decades, our near abroad was seen as a region of poverty and instability, and that historically we also saw ourselves as a long way from our cultural roots and therefore vulnerable. When Australia was part of the British Empire, these anxieties were largely held in check by the strategic reassurance that imperial power provided. Strategic anxiety may also be the reason why war has featured so prominently in our history. Australia is not a warlike country. We don't go looking for a fight. But despite our remote geography and relative isolation, we have accepted wars as a fact of life. We have been prepared to pay the price in blood and treasure, as our death toll in the First World War so graphically illustrates. The paradox is that our strategic anxiety sits side by side with a strategic geography which ought to be fundamentally reassuring. Our best strategic judgment for decades has been that we face no foreseeable threat. Our continental geography gives us strategic depth. We have a security alliance with the world's strongest military power, And these days, Asia is so much more a region of opportunity than instability. One result of this historical paradox, or unreasoning fearfulness, as one of my predecessors called it, is Australia has become adept at crafting a strategic policy which does not take as its starting point a clearly identified threat, a form of arming without aiming, to borrow a description once used to describe Indian strategic policy. All of this has had the effect of stretching Australia's strategic horizons. We think of our security across a very broad canvas, perhaps reflecting the fact that we initially learnt our worldview as part of the British Empire with its long geographic reach, and then further developed it as an ally of a global superpower. But if anxiety shaped our strategic worldview, the imperatives of trade have shaped our economic worldview. And as with strategic policy, geography has also been at the heart of our trade policy. Without a deep domestic market, blessed with natural resources and a competitive agricultural sector, and far away from our consumer market for the first two centuries of post-settlement history, Australia traded largely within an imperial framework. Imperial trade and domestic protection were the twin economic pillars, and foreign investment, a consistent theme in our economic growth, was also largely sourced from the centre of empire. We were alert to trade opportunities elsewhere, as evidenced in our 19th century relationship with Asia and our post-war trade relationship with Japan. But it was Britain's entry into the then European Economic Community which began the real broadening of our trade focus. And it wasn't until the 80s that we truly saw our future in global markets. Imperial trade and domestic protection gave way to global markets and a more open economy. And around the same time, our strategic policy also underwent profound changes, with a stronger emphasis on defence self-reliance and a greater confidence in our ability to defend Australia within an alliance framework. For Australia, the crucible of our security interests is Asia. It is here where our core economic and strategic interests lie, and it is from this region where any momentous disruption to our peace and prosperity is most likely to occur. Traditionally, our concept of Asia has focused on the Asia-Pacific as a coherent strategic system straddling the United States, the strategic heavyweights of Northeast Asia, and our closer neighbours in Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. More recently, we've also had to think about where India fits in. India has traditionally seen its strategic interests in neighbourhood terms, but as its interests in East Asia expand and as East Asian security dynamics take on more institutional substance, it makes sense to think of India as a key player in an Indo-Pacific strategic system, which also encompasses the United States, East Asia, and the South Pacific. An Indo-Pacific construct also better captures our expectation that the big strategic issues in our region will be maritime, such as conflicting maritime territorial claims and keeping open sea lanes vital for trade. By linking the Pacific and Indian Oceans, the Indo-Pacific construct also recognises Australia's distinctive geostrategic position as a continent which faces both oceans. This idea of an Indo-Pacific region is particularly important because we are living at a time of profound transition in the economic and strategic environment of Asia. A key question for Australian policymakers is how will the shift in economic weight in our region affect the distribution of power, and what will it mean for Australia's national interests? The meta challenge of Australian foreign policy over the medium term is how to maximise economic opportunity and minimise strategic risk as this larger rearrangement of economic and strategic weight works its way through our region. This involves a number of complicated judgments about how change will unfold and just what the strategic settling point of the Indo-Pacific will be. How should Australia position itself within this complicated and shifting dynamic? The last several decades have been decades of growth in Asia, but now virtually all the major Asian economies face deep structural economic challenges. In most cases, their political systems are struggling to embark on the reforms needed to address these challenges. It is here, at the intersection of economics and politics, that the biggest risks to the Asian growth story lies. And while Asia will undoubtedly continue to play a big role in Australia's economic future, the rising political economy risk in the region suggests we should also be alert to the need better to spread our economic risk. We also need to recognise that the Indo-Pacific strategic environment is in the midst of a profound transition as it moves towards a multipolar strategic system. The Asian growth story has been underpinned by a strategic stability underwritten by US strategic dominance. Now we are seeing other major powers rising in strategic weight. A more multipolar Asia means that Australia's security will depend even more on how the US, China, India, Japan, Russia, and others manage the complexity of their relationships. The character of those relationships, especially the US-China relationship, will be the single biggest determinant of strategic stability in Asia. At the heart of these relationships is the tension between economic interdependence and strategic competition. Asia will be a testbed of whether this tension can be effectively managed. Economic space is infinitely flexible. Strategic space tends to be much less so. The challenge of statecraft and leadership is to ensure that one does not derail the other. Discussion of the major power relationships is too often shaped around a narrative of US decline and China's rise. This underestimates both the capacity of the US to regenerate and the magnitude of the challenges facing China. It also tends to crowd out the contribution of the other major powers to the balance sheet of power in the region. With multipolarity, inevitably comes a reduced margin of influence for the United States. But for the foreseeable future, America's power will stay more multidimensional and more global than China's. The US will remain in a league of its own in global military reach and readiness to use force. Our alliance with the US is the bedrock of our strategic policy. The alliance is a deterrent to potential aggressors, an irreplaceable source of intelligence and defense technology, and a communion of values. The last is important because the convergence of interests and values is a powerful combination in foreign policy. China's influence will grow as its economic importance to other countries in the region continues to rise. We are today seeing a more confident China, with higher expectations that the region will naturally take China's interests into account when formulating national strategies. China is a country and a civilization which understands power, and its sense of place has been shaped by the many centuries in which it was the Middle Kingdom. That pull of history is likely to play an important role in the way in which China relates to regional states. China's leaders are acutely conscious of the many challenges they face. They are currently at the start of a profound transition in their economic model towards more market-based and consumption-driven growth with less emphasis on exports and fixed investment. The challenges posed by this transition are huge, and we underestimate them at our peril. It is a high-wire act which seeks both to preserve the monopoly of the power of the Chinese Communist Party while simultaneously allowing the market to determine the allocation of resources. There is no certainty about how this will end. We all, however, have a stake in the success of that transition. Abrupt shifts in China's strategic policies, especially flowing from economic crisis, would be highly destabilizing. No one gains if China fails. China will ultimately define its own strategic settling point. It will not be forced into someone else's view of what it should do or become. Nor is it realistic to expect that the US and China can negotiate some grand bargain to share power in Asia. The process of adjusting to shifting power balances in a multipolar Asia will be incremental and organic. China's behavior is likely to be a mix of many elements. It will be a responsible stakeholder where its interests are served. It will not be a classic revisionist power because China has been too much a beneficiary of the existing system to want to completely overturn it. But it will also look to play a greater role in existing institutions and to craft new institutions and arrangements which place it at the center in a pattern perhaps reminiscent of the Middle Kingdom. China has every right to seek greater strategic influence to match its economic weight. The extent to which this can be peacefully accommodated will turn ultimately on both the pattern of China's international behavior and the extent to which the existing international and regional order intelligently finds more space for China. Some assume that when China becomes the world's largest economy, it will seek to assert itself as the hegemon of Asia. But a China with the world's largest GDP will still be, in some respects, a relatively poor country with a relatively low per capita income. Its economic size will give it strategic leverage, but China's primary focus will also likely be domestic as it seeks to further increase the living standards and quality of life of its citizens. The same applies to India. The strategic behavior of a large, rich country and a large, poor country is not the same. To assume it is can lead to serious policy errors. Australian interests are best served by a stable strategic system in Asia, which favours open societies, encourages economic integration, is inclusive in membership, and looks outward. The US-China relationship may be the central axis around which Asia's strategic fate will be determined, but the other major powers are not going to be passive bystanders. The whole point about multipolarity is that strategic influence is spread more broadly. Japan's strategic perceptions will inevitably be influenced by a stronger China to which Japan's own economic fortunes are still tied. But Japan also recognizes that a brittle relationship with China is not in its interests or that of regional stability. So Japan is likely to continue with the priority it attaches to its alliance with the United States. Under the US security umbrella, Tokyo will keep moving to expand its strategic engagement and to cast off many of the self-imposed restrictions to becoming a more normal country in terms of defense and strategic policy. India, if it finds the path to sustained economic growth, will become a more important strategic player in the broader Indo-Pacific. And India, with a younger demography and growing faster than China, will exert influence in order of magnitude higher than now. But India's strategic preoccupations are likely also to remain close to home, especially Pakistan and China. Being on the periphery of the most contested Eurasian theatres, the Middle East and East Asia, gives India more room for strategic manoeuvre. How India will choose to use this is far from clear, although we can safely assume that India will want to march to its own strategic tune. Notwithstanding its expanding strategic relationship with the US, Japan, Australia, and others, it is unlikely to become anyone's ally. Russia is likely to stay a two-dimensional power, relying on energy, especially its huge gas reserves and nuclear weapons. Soft power will likely stay Russia's weak point. Its growing relationship with China will be more opportunistic than strategic. Moscow will retain a desire to cut the US down to size, and this may see more of Russia's European blocking agenda seep into its Asia policy. The future of the Korean Peninsula is one of the big unknowns in the region. When reunification comes, it will not only be costly in economic terms, but will also raise the question of the strategic disposition of a united Korea and the nature of its relationships with China and the US. Which way will a unified Korea lean, towards the US or China, or will it set out in a completely independent strategic direction? For Australia, Southeast Asia will always loom large in our worldview from both a security and economic perspective. And within Southeast Asia, the country that matters most to us is Indonesia. Indonesia is the natural leader of ASEAN, and the direction of its strategic policy and the strength of its economy will have a large influence on ASEAN's standing. The stability of Southeast Asia is central to our own security. We don't want to see a strategic fault line running through its middle. That is why ASEAN as an institution matters to Australia, because it has played a remarkable role in consolidating the strategic stability of Southeast Asia, as well as expanding its economic reach. But ASEAN will have to work harder to keep its strategic influence. Its economic integration agenda has been largely underestimated. A more economically integrated Southeast Asia will add economic heft to ASEAN, but the lack of a common strategic perspective will limit ASEAN's capacity to be a strategic shaper in the big powers environment of Asia. Australia has only a limited capacity to influence the relationships the major powers have with one another. We should be cautious of any suggestion that we can be a mediator or a bridge between great powers. What we can do is work on building institutions and norms in the region which can help manage strategic tensions and which can act as an anchor at a time of transition in the region. From Australia's strategic perspective, the EAS is the regional institution which has the highest priority and the most potential. Its members account for 55% of global GDP and half the global population. The EAS can complement the work of APEC in fostering greater economic cooperation. Australia's role in the founding of APEC and our active agenda in the EAS reflect the pivotal role we see for regional cooperation in advancing our national interests. A core objective of the EAS should be to nurture habits of consultation across the region. Consultation might not resolve problems, but it can make the search for solutions easier and diminish the risk of miscommunication and miscalculation. Ultimately, this is about the strategic culture we wish to see embedded in the Asian region. Will it be a culture of raw power or of consultation and collaboration? Will strategic behavior flow from what you can get away with, or will it reflect core principles about respect for international law? Asia is the strategic center of an Australian worldview, but Australia's horizons necessarily stretch much further. The Asian growth story doesn't mean that the world's future belongs to Asia. This century may not belong to any one country or region. By 2020, Asia will still only represent about a third of global GDP. Economic weight and strategic influence are becoming more dispersed. Some of the poles of power this century will be outside Asia, although the size of Asia's population means that it is likely to be unique in the scale of its economic growth this century. An Asia strategy only makes sense in the broader context of an Australian foreign and trade policy, which has a global focus. So our interests in Europe, the Middle East, Latin America and Africa are an important part of our worldview. Not all of foreign and trade policy is, of course, about opportunity. Geography imposes its own requirements. The South Pacific is Australia's near abroad. Our size and location make us the major power of the region. If things go bad in the South Pacific, both the region and the wider international community look to Australia to take a lead. And the successful management of our relationships in the South Pacific gives us extra weight in our dealings with the great powers of the Indo-Pacific and beyond. Our interests are best served by strong relationships with all countries in the South Pacific and by economic and aid policies which work in partnership with them to help grow their economies. We also have an interest in regional institutions which can address the unique challenges of microstates as well as the development challenges of the other Pacific Island economies. The challenges in the South Pacific are not uniform. The microstates wrestle with economic viability, which is why a deeper integration into the Australian economy and especially labour market are crucial to their prospects. For the larger Pacific Island states, the challenges are more ones of governance and private sector growth. Papua New Guinea has the scale and natural resources to be a wealthy country. Its stability matters to Australia, and the Australian market has a large role to play in its prosperity. In the past, our relationship has been dominated by aid. The future, however, will need to focus more on partnership, because more than any other single relationship, the state of our relationship with PNG is seen as a barometer of Australian foreign policy success. Beyond our core interests in Asia and the South Pacific, an Australian worldview needs to reflect the contribution which multilateralism can make to advancing our interests. Bilateral relationships are the bedrock of Australian foreign policy, but Australia can neither bully nor buy its way in the world, so an international rules-based order is in our best interests. An effective multilateral system is the surest way to get there. For most Australians, multilateralism means the UN, which, it must be said, has a very mixed record. Its political posturing can be annoying. Its inability to agree on decisive action can be frustrating. But for all its flaws, the UN does possess the unique legitimacy of universal membership, and the need for its essential peacekeeping role is increasing. Ultimately, the success of the UN is hostage to what its members themselves can agree to allow it to do. The truth is, if we did not today have the UN, we would have to invent it, warts and all. The multilateral system we have today is largely a post-war creation, and it has many achievements to its credit. Our international economy has undergone significant reform. Trade has been liberalised. Globalisation and more open WTO rules-based markets have delivered more prosperity and wealth around the world than ever before. Democracy and the rule of law are much more widespread than they were in the ashes of 1945. But today, multilateralism is under intense pressure. We need it more than ever, but it is not delivering on our expectations. There is a basic tension at the heart of global multilateralism, the mismatch between national power and global cooperation. Global multilateralism rests on the equality of states, but power resides with the handful of states with the strategic and economic reach to shape events. The story of multilateralism is the constant quest to expand the reach of the former and constrain the raw power of the latter. It works best when states with power accept that their broader interests are served by a system of international rules and norms which apply to all. What we may regard as universal, however, may not be how others see it. The current multilateral system is largely an invention of the United States and a clutch of Western countries. It reflects a post-war US view that the creation of global public goods was squarely in its national interest. This was unusual, to say the least. There is no historical precedent for the leading global power to define its interests as best served by a system of multilateral rules underpinned by the ideal of global public goods. For a country like Australia, the post-World War world would have looked very different, and much for the worse, if the US definition of its interests had been more narrowly framed. Today, emerging powers are no longer willing to accept rules they did not write or outcomes which they perceive do not take their interests into account. Some do not share the core values and interests of Western countries. Others favour state sovereignty over individual rights and so are wary of interventions in national affairs. And others still have shown little interest in taking a leadership role on the global stage. Unless we find a way to resolve these tensions and to refurbish the multilateral system, we will struggle to deal with the many challenges which can only be resolved through global action. Regionalism will get you only so far. Issues-based coalitions can achieve much, but neither can deal effectively with global challenges such as climate change or health pandemics or non-proliferation. The current edifice of global institutions is simply not strong enough to carry the weight of the challenges we face. The largest gap is the absence of a driving centre, a grouping reflective of the distribution of power in this century and capable of providing leadership on the big challenges of the future. Some see this as a role to which the G20 should ultimately aspire. Although there's no neat conceptual slot for it, in an Australian worldview, I would be remiss not to address the challenge of terrorism. Today, terrorism has become a first-order security issue for Australia, even if it has limits as a strategic threat in the classic sense of that word. The threat posed by terrorism is serious and rising. The rise of Daesh is a new chapter, and the threat it poses is not simply a continuation of the post-9/11 threat. A terrorist group with the ambitions of a state and already many of its attributes poses a different type of threat than a jihadist movement such as Al-Qaeda. Analytically, we have struggled to define the strategic magnitude of the terrorist threat. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and for some time thereafter, we were inclined to view Islamist terrorism as a global insurgency or a mass movement in the making. Some still do, and the threat we face does have elements of both. I think, however, that the more compelling analytical construct is to regard it as a potent combination of ideology and pathology. Terrorists are recruited at the intersection of ideology and pathology. To date, our efforts to counter violent extremism have placed most emphasis on countering the ideology. But as recruits in Australia become younger and the process faster, the pathological triggers will need much more attention. Extremist ideologies eventually exhaust themselves. Pathologies tend to be enduring. Let me conclude with these observations. We are at a moment in history when tectonic plates are shifting. Power is moving from west to east. Asia will see for the first time in centuries a clutch of powers which are simultaneously strong. New patterns of economic cooperation and interdependence are being built on long-standing strategic fault lines. The future will put a premium on policy nimbleness because we cannot be certain of either the strategic or economic trajectory of our region and beyond. This uncertainty will challenge us to recognize what will change and what will continue. It will be as much a test of mindset as of policy. Australia should face these challenges with a measure of confidence, We bring to it several assets. Australians understand the vocabulary of economic reform. Our history and our geography have combined to instill in us a global perspective. Ours is a society shaped by the values and institutions of the West, intimately connected to Asia, with economic interests across all regions, and a community which has found unity in the principles of a multicultural liberal democracy. Of course, none of this guarantees our success, and much of it can be overtaken by events outside our borders and beyond our control. Ultimately, the security and prosperity of our region and beyond will depend on our collective capacity to both understand and shape the forces which are redrawing our economic and strategic maps. It will be a testing time for our worldview. Thank you.
Well, excellent. Thank you, Peter. I thought that was a very comprehensive and subtle take on Australia's worldview. We have about 10 minutes or so of questions. Peter, I'll ask you to take the questions from the lectern if you like. I'm going to ask the first one. There's so many questions I could ask you about different regions and countries that you've mentioned, but I'm actually going to go back to the start of your remarks and ask you a question about Australia and about the way Australians perceive the world. You said that, if anything, we underestimate our weight in the world and our influence in the world. And you said that Australians have a discomfort with power. And I think I certainly detected that after the downing of MH17, for example, when a lot of the general commentary was, when Australia responded strongly, a lot of the general commentary was of the view, well, why would Mr. Putin care what Australia says? You know, we're just this little country. But in fact, as it happens, the tone of the remarks from our government and the diplomacy in New York did have an important effect on the resolution of that issue. So why are we so self-effacing and insecure, in a way, about our role in the world, given that on so many other issues, in other arenas, for example, sport, we're always seen as being forward-leaning and confident, even overconfident, even chippy? Why is it that when it comes to foreign policy and diplomacy, we're a bit more reserved?
Well, thank you, Michael. Look, I think the attitude that Australia has had historically towards power reflects the fact that our underlying strategic anxiety has implicitly been based on an acceptance that we cannot deal with direct threats to Australia on our own. And over time, of course, we have developed and changed that position. But one thing it has left us with is a feeling that we would much rather be in the slipstream of power than in the lead in power. And I think one of the geniuses of Australian strategic policy is that we have been able to manoeuvre our interest in the context of greater powers, the empire during the imperial days, the United States as a global power. That by itself, I think, is not unreflective of where our interests lie. I don't think any of the challenges that we're facing in the future is necessarily going to require Australia to be at the lead in the exercise of power in the region. There will be some occasions in the South Pacific where that would be required, and we've done so in the past, such as Ramsey. There have been other areas like East Timor where Australia ended up taking the lead. But this idea of being in partnership with a greater power and harnessing that relationship to our own interests, I think, is very deeply embedded in the way in which we think about the world and the way in which we exercise our diplomacy.
All right, thank you. Who would like to ask Peter a question? Yes, sir. If you could wait for the microphone, please. And as we only have a few minutes, I'm going to ask the questioners to keep their questions quite short, please.
Pavel Vanishkin, I work for the Russian News Agency TASS. Sir, about 2 months ago, in this very place, I asked the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, about the relations between Canberra and Moscow. And her answer was, if you let me to boil it down for you, it's a standstill. The sanctions are in place, and it would be in place. She didn't envision any changes in the foreseeable future, not for better, not for worse. And my question is to you right now, what's your current reading of the relations between Russia and Australia? Do you envision any changes for better or for worse? And if you do, why?
Well, you'll be surprised to know that I agree with the foreign minister. I did in my remarks try to make some observations about where Russia's policies and Australia's interests do intersect. I'd make two observations about Russia's position. The first is that Russia's European agenda does raise a number of very serious questions about the framework of international law and international norms that Australia has been a very strong advocate and defender of. And I think if we look at what's happening in Ukraine and if we look at what's happening elsewhere in Russia's near abroad, those concerns are quite serious. The Asian agenda is slightly different because I think Russia has been a country that has been a participant in regional institutions in Asia. It's been present at the high table, and for the most part, there's been quite a difference between Russia's Asian agenda and its European agenda. And that's actually been to the benefit of the development of regional institutions because there hasn't been the same set of difficulties in bringing Russia into our Asian regional institutions. I hope that that remains the case. I hope that we don't see, as I put it in my remarks, seeping into the Asian agenda some of the more negative and blocking characteristics that we've seen in Europe.
Thank you, Peter. With my hat on as chairman of the Australian Himalayan Foundation, I just wanted you to comment briefly on where you see foreign aid and its particular raison d'etre fitting into your what you call the meta challenge of, in the medium term, of maximising economic opportunity but minimising strategic risk, and particularly the role of NGOs in providing what I unashamedly say is an effective role in providing foreign aid, humanitarian assistance, and frankly in flying the flag for Australia.
Sure. Well, the partnership with non-government organisations is a very important part of our aid program. I mean, we deliver much of our aid program through non-government organisations, and I can't see that fundamentally changing. The real focus of our aid program now is how does it best contribute to economic growth? Because the touchstone of an effective aid program ought to be its capacity to contribute to sustainable economic growth. When you look at the flow of aid and the flow of other financial resources, aid is an infinitesimal amount of total financial flows. And so it's very important that we focus on where the value add of aid fits into the economic growth story. We've recently had to deal with a cut to the aid budget, and one of the principles we brought to implementing that cut was to draw a distinction between the type of contributions we can make in an aid program in the South Pacific and the type of contribution we can make in an aid program in a G20 economy such as Indonesia. In the latter, it's a question of focusing much more on an economic partnership and in niche areas, whereas in the South Pacific, I think the spread of the agenda is so much broader. So we do want the aid program to focus more on this core question of contributing to a private sector-led economic growth model, and that involves finding newer, better and more innovative ways of delivering aid. It also involves using more of our aid program to strengthen the trading capability of countries, in other words, the so-called aid for trade objective, to build up their wherewithal to engage in the international trading system and into the global economy. And I think that's likely to remain the sort of basic framework, but with a role for NGOs, you'll be pleased to know.
Peter, can I ask you about China? You spoke quite a bit about China. When we were at the Shangri-La Dialogue, all the discussion was about Chinese behaviour in its near seas, overly assertive behaviour. Strategists are worried about China's strengths. But in your remarks, you focused more, I think, on the magnitude of the challenges facing China's leadership. Do you think a country like Australia should be more worried about China's strengths or China's weaknesses?
I think what we need to focus on is understanding how the politics in China and the economic agenda in China come together and what that might mean, not just for China's growth trajectory, but what it might mean for the profile of Australia's economic relationship with China. China's economic growth may complicate our strategic environment, but there is no question that for the people of China, and I would argue more broadly, the success of China is a net good. Should we worry more about China's strengths or China's weaknesses? Well, if the weaknesses are such that it leads close to a collapse of the system, that would be a disastrous event for all concerned. As I said, no one gains if China fails. China's strength, a strong economy, an enmeshed economy in the global system, will create strategic challenges of the order that I've described. But, you know, I don't think we should convince ourselves that it's beyond our capacity to deal with those challenges.
I'll take one last question from Paul Maley, and then we'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Varghese. Paul Maley from The Australian. There's been some discussion in the last week that has around extending the bombing campaign from Iraq into Syria, or extending the Australian bombing campaign from Iraq into Syria. I'm just wondering what your view on that is, and also if you could, or how you would define Australia's own national interests in the Syrian-Iraq conflict.
Well, my view is not to articulate a view until the government has taken a position on it. I've found that's probably the safest position to adopt. Look, we are dealing, as I said in my speech, with a serious threat in the form of Daesh. And it is the case that this threat is across a single theatre which covers not just Iraq, but also Syria. And it is also the case that a great number of partners in the coalition against Daesh are conducting activities on both sides of that border. Australia's position up to now has been that we will restrict our involvement to the Iraqi side of the border because we are responding ultimately to a request from the government of Iraq for assistance in dealing with that threat. If we were to move beyond that in the way that many of our coalition partners have moved beyond that, it would be something that the government would need to consider, including, of course, the legal basis for any such move.
I'm going to break my own word and ask you one more question, Peter, because I do want to finish back on Australia, if I can, and diplomacy. As you know, the Institute has long argued for an expanded diplomatic network. And sometimes I get into arguments myself with economic types about whether we should be making this argument or not. So I wonder, how do you make the argument to the bean counters when you're making an argument for diplomacy and for Australia to invest in diplomacy? And when they say, look, it's all about living high on the lamb and cocktail parties and this isn't really fundamental to Australian interests, how do you boil down these conceptual thoughts about the world into making the argument for spending taxpayers' money on diplomacy?
Well, I think you do need to draw out the very direct connection between our capability in diplomacy and our ability to deliver on the core objectives of security and prosperity. So making the case that unless we have the wherewithal to conduct effective trade negotiations, we cannot conclude free trade agreements. And demonstrating that the conclusion of free trade agreements creates opportunities for Australian goods and services, which in turn contributes to a stronger Australian economy. So I think the lines of sight between what we do in the field on the trade side and our interests, our national interests being advanced, are fairly clear cut. The argument on the political and strategic side is more complicated, but it is no less removed in my view, because ultimately, if you don't have security, there's not much point having a lot of trade. So the two need to be handled in tandem. And I think it's also the case, and I don't think many could argue with this, that in many ways Australia is more dependent on an effective diplomatic presence and network than many other countries, because we are not a member of a large bloc. We don't have an EU, or we don't have the proximity of the United States economy next door. We live and operate and have to make our way in a world and in a region where in many ways we survive by our wits. And being able to do that, and to do that effectively, does require a diplomatic capability, which I think is essential to our future. So sometimes you just have to keep plugging away with the bean counters.
Ladies and gentlemen, I said at the beginning that Peter's one of the finest thinkers that DFAT has produced. I think you saw that in the breadth and the level of interest, interesting comment in his speech. You also saw in the way he dealt with some of the more complicated questions from our Russian friend and from the Australian that he's a pretty good operator as well. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Peter Varghese. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Let me just mention that next Wednesday we have Peter Singer, the very well-known American strategist, talking here at the Institute on the Future of War. And, of course, the 2015 Lowy Lecture by General David Petraeus is being held on the 2nd of September at the Sydney Town Hall. Today is the last day to secure tickets to the Lowy Lecture, so I hope to see many of you at one or both of those events. Thank you very much.